I'm Donald Glover, and you are watching or listening to the Post Credit Scene Podcast.
Post Credit Scene Podcast, a 14HQ original. We are lovers of film and TV, the biggest lovers of film and TV. I am your host, Gaz. I am joined by my right honourable members of the pod.
Woo!
Hussam.
Let's go, baby!
Wagwan.
Wagwan, man.
How'd you do?
Really good, man.
Yes, sir?
Really good, yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. Feeling good. Yeah. Cut my finger.
What were you doing?
This guy laughed immediately. No, I was just washing some dishes and, you know, hit a glass. The glass cut me and I'm here, you know.
Very interesting.
Domesticated, are you?
Yeah, man, you know, it's just a single life, isn't it? You get me? It's got a...
Man said, I'm going to float that out there for people.
It's good, you know.
Just so you know.
My thing, handsome, got a trim. Skin looking good. You know, under age of 30. Shout me.
Shout me for real. Manny.
Yes, broski.
How'd you do?
I'm doing all great, you know.
Yes, sir.
Summer is around the corner.
Around
the corner. Excited for it. Gonna get some drinks in finally.
Come on, let's go, let's have it.
I think the first drink I'm gonna have is when we record next, right after the pod. Well, actually, during the pod.
Yeah, we're gonna record next Sunday. Yeah. The plan is for us to do some content around a big month in June for TV. We've got The Bear season 3, we've got House of the Dragon season 2, and we've got The Boys season 4. There's also Star Wars The Acolyte, which is a new Star Wars series, which comes out on the 5th of June. So yeah, it's a big bump for TV, to be honest with you.
Yes, sir.
And we're going to do our best to cover that as much as we can. Today, we are going to celebrate the 5th anniversary since Game of Thrones first ended. So 5 years ago, Game of Thrones ended on season 8. It didn't end in a positive way, I would say, for fans and audiences and critics alike. But for me and for us, it's still a series that deserves to be sort of honoured and celebrated due to its huge impact on the scope of TV and how it's looking today, you know? Yeah. And I think that was probably one of the last sort of shows from that time anyway that I would have deemed as sort of prestigious TV, you know? And I think the only other show since then might be like a Succession. So yeah. I think Defo deserves a huge conversation. Just due to the fact also that it converted people from someone like myself who was never really a fantasy guy, to become a guy that, like...
That's really surprising to me.
It's not that I wasn't. I wasn't. Okay. But it's not like I was against fantasy. But, like, remember, Lord of the Rings wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
No, I was about to mention that to you. Do you know, I just finished watching The Hobbit. I'm on the second Lord of the Rings film.
Right.
And I take back what I said in the last episode, okay? And I
it wasn't on this episode.
It was in the Popcorn podcast. Yeah, I said to you, watch Lord of the Rings first.
Watch Lord of the Rings first.
1 second. I take back. Watch The Hobbit first. Because...
Excuse me.
Have you ever done it in that order?
No, I don't need to.
Okay, cool. Thank you. So anyway, okay. I've done it in both orders, right? And I'm telling you now, it's a lot more satisfying watching it, The Hobbit first,
Manny's
all the way through. And the only reason why, okay, is because in Lord of the Rings 1, it actually leads off 100 years after, also 70 years or 60 years, sorry, after The Hobbit. But Frodo goes through the same journey that Bilbo does for the first, like,
don't
half
know who's
an hour.
On that.
But cool. But like, it ties in so perfectly. And then also the last scene of The Hobbit in the third one is the beginning scene of the first Lord of the Rings. It ties in so beautifully, mm-hmm. and it's I think it's a more emotionally driven series than Lord of the Rings. I really recommend it, bro.
Okay,
really recommend it.
Decent. What we'll do? I set the guys a task, and we're going to go to that first before we celebrate the greatness of Game of Thrones. Recently, The Hollywood Reporter announced their top 10 A-list young actors currently.
Are we doing this now?
Yeah, we're going to do that first.
Okay.
And, it, you know, it drew some controversy, some conversations around sort of list and why people are in certain positions.
Is it?
So would you guys rather I read you out the list first and then we discuss? Or would you rather say your top 10 and then we reveal the actual top 10 after? Where do you want to go with this?
Let's go, what Huss wants to do. We can do reveal our first top 10.
Okay.
Which one to go first?
Are you sure?
I'm fine.
I've got 11.
By the way, I think theirs wasn't in a specific order, just to be clear.
Okay, so I don't have to order mine, yeah?
Yeah, so we don't have to order them. I think that makes that's.
I've ordered mine, but it's calm.
Yeah, if you've ordered it, it's even better. It shows you're more prepared than us. It's fine.
Okay, I've ordered it in regards to acting, prowess, and stardom.
Okay, so you want to read yours first?
Yeah,
sure.
Go ahead. What is your top 10 from 10 to 1?
Okay, cool.
They're under 35 as well, right? Just to be clear.
All under 35.
Cool.
10 and 11 were my, like...
Interchangeables.
Yeah, and okay. They were my, like, young horses. And it was Dominic Fawn and Ashton Saunders.
Okay.
So Ashton Saunders is in the Equalizer 2. I love him because he was, like... he came into acting like pretty late,
mm-hmm.
and then he had this moment on the red carpet, okay, with Denzel, where he says, "Yo, like, I'll be in a movie with you soon." And he was all right, cool, I'll see you at work. And then obviously they done the Equalizer 2, and mm-hmm. he was really good in it. And then he's been really good in loads of other things.
Oh, he's in Moonlight, the show that you like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's also
the film. Sorry, film you like.
He's also in a keep going. It's recent.
All day and a night, Captive State, Native Son, The Equalizer, Whitney Houston.
That's the one.
Okay.
He plays Boy Brown.
Oh, okay, yeah, cool.
So
who is your actual 11 and who's your 10?
I'm going to go with him at 10 and Dominique just as the honourable because she hasn't had like bare roles, mm-hmm. but I just feel like her as like Ironheart is good.
She's got Ironheart cool. coming out next year. We will talk about that very briefly because Marvel did some announcements this week, which are going to be quite interesting to talk about.
Do you know what? This episode, we'll go the other way around. At the end, we'll talk about what we've been watching and stuff.
Oh, okay, yeah, quick brief, whatever. Yeah.
So, yeah, 10, I'm going Ashton Saunders. At 9, I'm going Kiki Palmer. I think her role in Fiend Nope was sick. And I think obviously she's still doing what I love about her. Yeah, is that she still does these black, like, comedy led films,
mm-hmm.
but can also kind of really dive into
big blockbuster if you need to.
Exactly, uh-huh. Like she's doing like the new Barbershop, man. Do you know what I mean? Sick. Like, yeah, and I think outside of it,
she's a star.
Exactly.
She's just a star.
As an A-list star, she's a star.
She's got the personality of a star.
She's got a fantastic personality, bro.
That's not a bad shot. We're the same age.
Oh, is it?
She's 30. I didn't realise.
Shit, then.
She looks good, man.
Number 8, just based on movie roles and what she's done so far in the industry in such a short amount of time, Margot Robbie.
Yeah. Yeah, not bad.
Is she under 35?
Under 35, my dear. She's 33, I think. Crazy, isn't it?
Bro, crazy. She's been around.
Hey, when I was doing this list,
I think Margaret is a top 10.
No, 100%.
She's a top 10.
That's what I'm shocked. Did he know she was under 35?
She's top 10.
Bro,
I'm changing my 30, one right now.
Bro, I had 30 people on my list yesterday that I was cutting down. It was so difficult, yeah. At 7 is a personal favorite of mine. It might not be people's, but I think he's one of the most underrated actors in the world, and that is Lakeith Stanfield.
Yeah.
Brother, let's go.
He's on my list as well.
I originally wanted him to play Wonka. You know, I thought he would have an incredible role. And I also want him, if they ever go black with Joker, I think he'll be an amazing Joker. Number 6, just because she's been able to do the whole like comedy thing, but also she's proved that she's franchise worthy, and that's Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, Jeff Lawrence.
There's no way she's under 35.
She is. Under 35,
Brody. Obviously, Hunger Games series speaks for itself, and it was against Harry Potter and Star Wars and at the time, and it done really, really well.
She had no hard feelings last year as well.
No Hard Feelings was hilarious.
Good film. Yeah, good film. She obviously had her role in the X-Men as Mystique, which started off well for her, and then it sort of...
It
nosedived in tandem with the X-Men franchise.
Exactly.
That nosedive.
Not her in particular. But also, she... she did go through a phase where she was the biggest, like she was the highest paid female actor in, mm-hmm. And I think she had a bit of an L. It was when she was doing like for Netflix films like Mother and that kind of stuff, and she took a bit of an L that way. But mm-hmm. And she's also in Passengers, right? She's fantastic in that as well.
Okay,
with Chris Pratt. Number 5. The top 5 was really, really tough. Really, really tough. Number 5, he wouldn't have been on my list if you asked me January last year, okay. But I'm going with Timothée Chalamet.
Okay. Oh, he's easily a top 5.
He's easily a top 5. He's proved everybody.
He picks good films.
Good films picked him, I think.
Okay, let's go into the tandem of them. Yeah, cool. I'm with you. Cool.
I just think like he's the first actor ever to do 2 billion pound films in the same...
Wonka and Dune 2, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. in the same season. Mm-hmm. You know,
he also had that film King, which is on Netflix, I think, right?
Yeah. I mean, also, I think he had the persona of, like, models can't be, like, actors and blah, blah, blah. And he killed it, bro. Like, he's transitioned fantastically. The roles that he's had as well are two very different roles. I mean, sorry, every role that he does is very, very different. So. Number four... Zendaya,
not mad. Yeah, she's a top. She's had an unbelievable year.
Yeah. Unbelievable year, and also she's had the underrated 5 years. Like when you look back,
Malcolm and Marie,
Spider-Man. Like she's had a very underrated. Euphoria. Yeah, she's a very underrated 5 years. And
I think the one stick that people throw at her is that she's one dimensional. But that, at some point I would like to see something different. But she does it well, man.
She does it really well, and she does this whole Mystique character really well.
I'd love to interview her though.
Yeah. Oh yeah. My gosh, she'd be a great interview. Yeah.
I'm glad that Jason's not here. We'll see his ankle.
Number three, also I think one of the most underrated actors of our time. I think Letitia Wright.
Interesting. Okay.
She's in there for me just because of the film that she done last year with Tamara Lawrence as well. I think about the sisters. Okay. It's cool, but that film was outstanding. I think she was like breathtaking, and she done it in the same time as her run with Black Panther. And the fact that she's now like the black woman holding that franchise, and everybody was so worried about that film.
Excuse me.
Arguably, and that film was fantastic. Mm-hmm.
She's my top thing as well.
Yeah, so like I rate her, and I hope she does more. Obviously, like you know, back in the day as well. Top Boy, Black Mirror, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? Just outstanding, man. Top two. Second, I put Florence Pugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. I think she's been... Oh, my God, bro. She's in some of my favourite films, man. You know what I'm saying? Like Equalizer, Oppenheimer, fucking everything, bro. Like, she's just outstanding. She's even in Dune, which I'm expecting her to be incredible in, like, in the second one. Sorry, the third one. And she was even good in the second one. Mm-hmm. I think she is probably one of the most dynamic actors in this.
She's very dynamic here.
Yeah. You know, she can just, like, switch up from being this, like, sexy, kind of, like tempting woman to being this deep, dark, dramatic. You know, it's just, yeah, she's great. And funny.
Yeah.
She could also do that too.
Yeah, she's very charismatic. Must say.
Anyway, number one, I think, is on most people's list, maybe, but I'm going with Tom Holland.
Okay. Really?
I think all the factors.
Number one is mad.
All the factors we said about. I don't think he's the best actor out of the 10, right? But I think he's good enough to be in the top three. And then I don't think he is. Sorry. And then how we spoke about Kiki and Jennifer Lawrence, that off camera, they are just like, they're so charismatic. They're so sellable. And the fact that he's doing Romeo and Fee Juliet just to prove his acting prowess. I love that. Like Benedict Cumberbatch did that. Robert Downey Jr. Did that. When they felt like they were so stagnated in the one role, they went and done theater. Mm-hmm. When they were at their peak. You know what I mean? That's just, I think that's so impressive.
Okay.
And then when I was going through his discography, not the best films, but he was solid in a lot of these films.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? And they were very, very, very different roles. And I'm glad that he didn't get pinholed in this like action man type thing where he was doing the game. What's it called again? Sorry. The game.
I know what you're talking about. I can't remember the name.
With Mark Wahlberg.
I can't remember.
He could have easily been pigeonholed as a, I'd say this, as like a Kevin Hart, Dwayne The Rock Johnson guy, where people are just going to films just to watch him. Mm. They don't care about his acting. But then he started picking films like C, and you know what I'm saying, and different films which were on like Apple TV and Prime and stuff. Sick. So yeah, like, and he's young, he's really young, and I think he can be the star of what, the biggest franchise in the fucking world, which is Marvel. And I think he can generally be the star of that now.
Cool. I'm a fly through, man, without too much explanation, because you did a good job for some of these. Yeah. I've got Lakeith Stanfield. I'd probably put him 10 as a rough estimate, just guessing. I'd have 9 as Jeremy Allen White. Bias, I know. I'll put my hands up, but I loved him in...
The Bear.
in Iron Claw this year, and the Bear on the last two years. The Bear season 3 is coming out as well. Was that
I didn't think of him, but that's a shout.
So I've got him number 9. Roughly, I'm going to say number 8 is Jodie Comer. Oh. Loved her in The Last Duel, and I think she's incredible in Killing Eve. Like scarily good in Killing Eve.
Yeah.
Versatile, various in accents. Her depictions of the different characters in Killing Eve is so good. So yeah, I'm going to go 8, Comer. So shout out to the Brits as well, you know the vibe.
Yeah.
7, Ayo Edebiri.
She was on my original.
She's been working.
She just had a crazy year last year.
I get you.
Yeah. So I've got her 7. I've got 6, Anya Taylor-Joy.
She was also on my provisional list, but when I was like, I don't think she's had a role yet where I've gone raw.
I watched her in Mad Max. Furiosa and Mad Max Saga, and I was like, yeah, bro. That's when I was like,
yeah, was it?
Yeah, Anya Taylor-Joy.
Sorry.
She's in Furiosa.
Yeah, she's in Furiosa.
Yeah.
So. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
I thought she was incredible. I thought she was better than Hemsworth.
Woo.
I do. 100%. 100%. That's another topic for another day. So number 5, Florence Pugh. You've said it. You've said everything. Number 4, Barry Cohen.
Also on one of my provisional lists.
Number 4, Barry Cohen.
To my list.
Number 3.
The only reason why I didn't put Monica is because it was A list. I mean, I was like, I don't think he's there yet.
Cool.
But he's fantastic.
Yeah, I think my list is more like an acting than like an overall basis. So I think yours is more well-rounded than mine, if I'm honest. Number 3, Austin Butler. I think he did a good job as Elvis.
Fantastic.
I think he was incredible in Dune.
He was pigeonholed for a while, though. I think Dune saved him a little bit. Because
Dune's
because
opened up the realm and the market for him.
Yeah, people were like, oh, he's doing
the one voice.
Elvis voice now. And he's like, yo, it just changed. This is my voice. It's like, how can you just change?
It can, though.
I know, but it's such a particular voice, though, isn't it?
Number 2, Zendaya. Challengers, Dune.
Yeah.
Good year.
MJ, yeah. Euphoria, yeah. Malcolm and Marie, yeah. Number 1 is Timothée Chalamet. It's hard to dispute his year in terms of one car leading into Dune. And I think he was incredible. I thought it was not incredible in Dune. That's overstating it. I thought it was very good in Dune, part 2. That's my 10, man. Some of my honourables, Nicholas Hoult. Could have easily been there. Tom Holland probably should be in there in terms of like stardom. Callum Turner is like a secret one. I think he's a really, really good actor. And obviously Dev Patel is like another sort of.
Dev Patel was on my list as well, yeah.
But I think just needs a bit more from him.
Yeah, a bit more. Another year. Listen, sometimes all it takes is like one or two films and boom.
But it's a shame because obviously like from early on, he already starred in a film that won.
Slumdog, right?
Yeah. So.
Laffy Pie.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so see how it goes from there. But okay, I'm going to fly through mine as well. I might talk a bit more about the ones that's
what I mentioned before.
I mentioned it. Obviously, Barry is on my list as well. Great, great actor. I got Jacob Elordi.
Mainly
because I feel like his niche in terms of, I think he's going to be the Hollywood hot frob when it comes to like those romantic comedy films, or just any films with romance element, even if it's a thriller. Like, for example, Saltburn. He was essentially the romantic eye in that film, and I think he did a good job at it. And I feel like there's not that many actors out there that can play that role so well.
Cool.
I think he has a niche, and this is a place for him within Hollywood for that. Paul Mescal, I think, is a brilliant actor. I think he's really amazing. Obviously, he's going to be starring in Gladiator. Looking forward to that. I think he's done so amazing. Bro, what a performance in that film. I haven't watched After Sun, but a lot of people told me how great it is. So I'm going to give a watch probably some point this week, actually. Paul Mescal's in as well. Letitia Wright, again, this is the Kiki Palmer one. I completely hear it. Wish I thought of it as well. But Letitia Wright was similar. Lane-ish is not just because of black women, but unfortunately in Hollywood, those type of roles are quite limited.
Yeah.
And doesn't allow the space for enough of us,
but I think that's why we have to concentrate on the British roles as well.
So I feel like Letitia Wright has a bit more range in terms of some of the roles that she's already done in the past.
Exactly.
From going from Black Panther to the one that she done last year with the twins, I can't remember the name.
Yeah, with Tamara Lawrence. I forgot what it's called, but I'll find out.
Surrounded?
No.
But there's another film.
But Surrounded is the cowboy one.
Yeah, she. And I feel like she tries to do different type of roles. So I'm really looking forward to see what she does more. I do think she has a great future in her. Head of Hollywood, Lakeith Stanfield, already talked about him. Brilliant actor. I think he's really funny and very well arranged. I got John Boyega on my one.
Okay.
I feel like he's a great actor. And I know he was in Star Wars. He wasn't necessarily a main character within it, from my understanding.
No, he was.
I haven't watched it. Because I've seen him complain quite a bit, saying that they kept having me in these promotional videos, but I wasn't that much into the film. They just the Silent Twins. They just used me to sell the film when I wasn't.
No, but that's a different problem. He was the main actor, but they were teasing that he was like a Jedi. Do you know what I'm saying? So then that's people like, oh my god, they were definitely using him like 1,000%. But he wasn't. He was the main actor, but he wasn't the main storyline, which might not make any sense. But he was the main actor. He probably got the most screen time, okay? But the story was the whole... Was the girl and Skywalker and blah, blah, blah. It wasn't really him. He was just the main focus.
Got you. Cool. And my final two, no surprise to anybody, Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya.
Yeah. Cool.
Not mad. I'm not mad, yeah. Okay, let's go. Top 10, according to the Hollywood Reporter. We'll fly through this because we've got a lot to talk about today. So, Austin Butler is in the top 10. They titled him the Golden Boy.
Okay.
Austin Butler, top 10. Timothée Chalamet, The Sure Thing. I think I get what they mean. You know what you're going to get, guaranteed at least a good performance.
Well, now you do, though. You know what I'm saying? I don't think he was a sure thing prior to Dune and Wonka. Even first Dune, people didn't really say much.
Yeah, but we're talking about now, bro.
Yeah, I know.
Jacob Elordi, The Shy Heartthrob.
Yeah.
We got Paul Mescal, the Art House Prince.
Do you know that makes complete sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Jenna Ortega, The Gen Z Obsession.
I thought of that too, but I was like, yeah, cool.
Glenn Powell, The Megawatt Smile. I don't know what that means, Megawatt Smile. But he's a good-looking chap, and he was good in Anyone But You, I enjoyed that film. Florence Pugh, The Chameleon. I get it.
The Chameleon. Yeah. To be fair, that's exactly what we said.
Sydney Sweeney, The Hustler. Sydney Sweeney's... I get it.
Tits McGee, man.
Did I mention Sydney Sweeney?
No.
But she's on my list.
Oh, yeah, cool. Sydney Sweeney.
I must have skimmed through her. But yeah, she's in mine.
Sydney Sweeney. Anya Taylor-Joy, The Genre Queen. Zendaya, The Unicorn. And that's the top 10.
Sorry, I missed Sydney Sweeney and Austin Butler on my list. But okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense with those two. What do you guys think of their list?
Makes sense. Not enough black people, but makes sense.
Yeah, it's very, very white.
Yeah, very
white. Quite.
Very, very white, yeah.
Yeah, quite.
I actually struggle to put men in my list, you know.
What do you think that is?
I don't know. When I was looking at performances, I was just... I was looking at, like, bare guys, and I was like, I don't know.
Unmoved.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair.
Okay. Interesting, man. Guys, we're going to talk about one of the segment away. We're going to talk about one of the greatest moments in our lives, I would say, from a cinematic television perspective. Series that took over everyone's lives. It took over pop culture, if you like. Quotes, memes, scenes, highlights, great episodes of television, Game of Thrones. Before we delve into what we're going to talk about today, what does Game of Thrones, or what did it mean to you when it first came out? When did you first get into the series? This is an open question to the floor. Like, why was Thrones a series that you got into, and what made it stick for both of you?
I think I got into it from season one. I read the...
Really?
The first game of...
Like, when it came out?
I read it after it came out. So the series came out, and I think... I can't remember if I read it in between the series. Mm. It was around the same time. I can't remember specifically. So I read the first book of A Song of Fire and Ice. But I can't lie, I don't really care for...
The way he writes. Yeah, I remember you saying you're not a fan of George R. R. Martin's writing style, right?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan. Mm-hmm. Lovely storytelling, just not a huge fan of the style of writing specifically. He writes like a historian. But yeah, around the time, I've always been a fan of fantasy in general. And Game of Thrones just brought it to life in a way that I've never seen before in television. Give me anything to do with dragons and magic and sword fighting, and I'm there. So I was really happy to see it, and obviously it was very, really popular. A lot of people talk about it, and actually I gravitate towards it and just stuck around.
I'm very different, very, 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 very different. I watched it because of you and Anand.
George was in Fifi's house.
Yeah.
It must have been. Oh. Look at me being an influencer.
So I didn't get into it till you guys were like, yo, we're going to do a watch party. I think we've done it at Jackie's house for the first episode of a new season. It was season 3 or 4, something like that. And then I was like, oh, shit, okay, cool. So let me catch up. I remember at the time as well, I was watching Green Arrow and all of them things. So I was so obsessed with that, but I didn't really get out of anything. But on the site that I was watching it on, there was bare ads for Game of Thrones. And I was like, fuck's sake. And then obviously after You Man were like talking about certain things. And
yeah, we were obsessed with that show.
Yeah.
We were obsessed.
And we spent a lot of time together, so I was like, all right, cool, here we go. And yeah, I caught up, I think, a week before this season 4. Season 3. And then I think the way that I watched the first episode of the new season was really beautiful. Like, everybody there were drinking, chilling, whatever, da, da, da. And then obviously it comes on, everyone's silent. Everyone's just like this, everyone watching, and I just thought, like, this is freaking sick. The fact that something like this can bring us, especially that we're like all black and everything, to bring us all together to watch something that makes is crazy, bro.
Yeah, because fantasy as a whole is a completely different world naturally, and I think Thrones. When you think about Thrones, you think about dragons. Like, if you're not into the series, it just looks so obscure and it looks like a gated community. Like, it's not meant to be for someone like myself or you guys. Not that it isn't. And that's the way it sort of feels. So when I got told to watch the series, it was through an old friend. It was through an old friend, and like,
what's the laugh about?
It was a specific person, so that's why I laughed.
Shout out to you, Wayne. Hope you're doing well. It's your loss, isn't it?
She's cool, man. She's cool. but yeah, she put me on. She was like, you need to watch this series. I think I started season 3 launched, or season 4, one of the two. She said, oh, you need to get the book as well. I started reading the book because of her. Started watching the series. And it took me, I'd say, 3 attempts to get past the first episode. On different occasions. Different occasions. Like, maybe, let's say in January I tried, couldn't get into it. Let's say April comes, I tried again, couldn't get into it. But I know it sounds crazy to say when you're talking about the show, why are you persevering? If you like it, you like it. But I persevered, got to the end of the episode where obviously push comes to shove, if you like. And from there on in, I slowly but surely just got roped into this world of, and we're going to discuss this stuff later, of politics, politicking, dialogue, words, and the way words can be used to manipulate. And I think Thrones, as we've said numerous times on different times when we've podded together, Thrones was able to sort of capture my attention through that. And I guess as someone that studied like journalism and media and was like really intrigued by the use of words, that also just really started to like really capture my attention was like characters like Varys and Littlefinger, and just the way they were able to use words. So yeah, that was my introduction to Thrones. I think it was just a groundbreaking series. It captivated us. Great storylines, the way they interlinked and the vast nature of the Game of Thrones universe. But they all still had like somehow one storyline from let me not say specific places because I might get it wrong, but like one area in Westeros can link to a completely different story going on in another world, and they interlink. So yeah, for me, plot twist, great acting for the most part.
Really.
Actually, you know what, I cannot fault the acting throughout the series.
Yeah,
that's one thing I can never do for me is personally, like, I can't think of one actor other than maybe Ed Sheeran's guest appearance. Who cares about that, really, truly? Like, there wasn't a bad acting performance.
What's so weird? Dave Beckham was better.
He's been dumb, isn't it? You been dumb?
Nah, he was it.
Bro, he did.
Dave Beckham was in Game of Thrones.
Current guy.
Oh, you man on crack, yeah? I don't know.
Bro, you're being stupid. So what we're going to do, we're going to fly through our top 10 Game of Thrones moments of all time to celebrate the 5-year break since Game of Thrones ended. We have discussed, we have debated, friendly actually, to be fair, friendly debate, nice debate, about what our top 10 is going to be. What we're first going to do is read out an honourable mention from each other. Manny's going to go first. You're going to say why it's an honourable mention. We're not going to clip up. We're not going to play the clip for the honourable mentions. But what we will do is for the top 10, we'll play like a minute segment from each clip, from each sort of moment that we discuss. Manny, what is your honourable mention for the top 10 moments of Game of Thrones? And why?
Sure. My honourable mention comes from season 2, episode 1. Cersei having a conversation with Littlefinger. And I think Littlefinger alludes to the fact that Cersei and Jaime had relations.
Okay. who are Cersei and Jaime?
The brothers, the twin brothers.
Crazy times.
The Lannisters, they'll always repay the debt. So he alludes to that fact, and obviously alluding to the fact, they're not even alluding, Strat says that knowledge is power. And Cersei takes that remark as, I don't know, I feel like a mark of disrespect. And Cersei is the queen mother, I think, will be her.
Queen mother at the time, yeah.
Yeah, it'll be queen, she'll be the queen mother.
No, at the time she was...
Season 2. So she wouldn't be the mother.
Yeah, Joffrey was king.
You're right.
They're all surrounded by guards, obviously. You surround
King's guard.
Eventually just orders them to do whatever she wants them to do, to seize him, to put a knife to his throat,
turn around,
take 3 steps back. Eventually Mark saying that power is power, and there was no better way to showcase that, and I really love that scene.
As a rebuttal to Littlefinger saying knowledge is power, right? It's so good. And I think the powerful thing about that scene is Littlefinger using his knowledge, which still served him well throughout the series, but it ties in essentially to what happened to Ned Stark the season before, where obviously the lineage of the Baratheon son, Joffrey Baratheon. So I think it's a good pick. I think it could have easily been a top 10 contender just for its the sheer force of the acting to pick Cersei in that way.
And also showcases what the characters are about and who they are in nature just off that scene, with Littlefinger putting so much emphasis in knowledge, because that's what he doesn't know how to fight.
He
doesn't have power.
That's his currency.
That is his currency, his knowledge. While Cersei's currency has always been power. She was born into a powerful family. She married a powerful man. She has a powerful child in the king of the land. So that's her currency. That's her understanding of the world. That power is power. What Littlefinger's knowledge is power. But yeah, great scene.
Hussam, you've got... Please, wait to 2 minutes, because I know you're going to pod.
Nah, listen, man. Tywin skinning the stag was just, for me, it was one of the greatest scenes that I've ever seen with no beef. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, just the significance of it as well. Okay, it's just
give
like,
some backstory to it quickly for those.
Well, the backstory is that directors and that, okay, we're talking to Tywin,
Charles Dance, I believe his name is.
And they were talking about like stuff that, you know, he kind of can't do. Evan, they were like, Evan, he said that he can obviously skin a deer. Evan, they were like, what? Evan, they were like, all right, cool, do it on camera. Evan, he was like, yeah, cool. Evan, like he actually done it, and they changed it to a stag, obviously to represent Baratheon. You know, that the killing of the stag. You know, we'll get that changed. And just like that whole scene, okay, is the first time, like, I think up until then, we get an idea of what being a Lannister is. But because Tyrion, Jaime, and Cersei are all kind of like foundationally the same, and then they're all so overtly different, right, that you're almost like, how can they be from the same family?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Then you watch this guy who embodies all of them. Mm-hmm. Everything, like the genius of him is in Tyrion.
Tyrion, for
okay.
Sure.
Like,
and I think he doesn't like the fact that it's Tyrion.
Hates him. Yeah, he wishes it was Jaime, right?
Yeah.
The furiousness of him is obviously is obviously, I think, Jaime, right? And then like the willing to do anything for the family,
Cersei. Yeah.
Right. And it's just like you watch it all in him in that scene when he is, and even just like the point that he's like controlling like the stag, it just shows how much he is in control of the whole situation. He knows what he's doing without even thinking or looking at what he's doing. He knows his next move constantly, and he's explaining that to Tyrion. And it's funny because at the time, Tyrion's almost like, here we go again. I've heard this 1,000 times, whereas we're hearing it for the first time. It wasn't for Tyrion, it was for the audience.
Yeah,
you know, and it was just fantastic. It was a brilliant scene. And then after that, okay, you almost understand everything Tyrion does. You almost understand everything Versace does and Jaime does, because they're all parts of him.
Right.
You know, and even the way that he dies, obviously, if he later on, okay, is just like, you know, how he even says he foreshadows it and says in like scenes before, oh, you know, dying on the toilet is like shameful. Da, da, da. He says it like 4 episodes prior, and then it happens to him.
No, right.
Do you know what I mean? And it's like his death is the only thing that he couldn't foresee. You know, and yeah, I just think that scene just set the precedent for six seasons.
Mm.
Yeah.
My pick is going to be Chaos Isn't a Pit, Chaos Is a Ladder, between Varys and Littlefinger. And for me, this scene essentially showed us who these two characters were. Yeah. Very similar, but also very different. I believe both wanted power in a sense, but saw it in different ways.
Yeah.
Littlefinger was very much opportunistic and very like self-centered in his pursuit for power. And he would do absolutely everything in a conniving and cunning way to get that power. Whereas I think Varys was a bit more secretive and a bit more elusive in a sense of his pursuit for power. And he tried to align himself amongst the people that he thought would be the most powerful, which we see when he ends up teaming up with Daenerys later on in the season.
Don't you think it's funny? Like, I think he had more... I think he had. I think he assumed that Littlefinger had more arrogance, right? But I actually believe that Varys had just a shameless arrogance, where it was like he knew everything he was gonna do, but he didn't mind going the shameless.
Wouldn't you say Littlefinger's more shameless than Varys?
Nah,
I would say so.
But towards the end of K3, Littlefinger was pretty much on the nose. Like he was trying things like very like overtly, blatantly.
Yeah, that's
whereas,
what.
Whereas like,
that's Varys, the shameless
till,
nature. That's
that... till he died, he was doing it just back doors.
Yeah, but oh yeah, so we agree. I misunderstood what you're saying. Yeah. I agree. I think Littlefinger was much more obtuse and sort of on the nose in terms of his pursuit for that.
Yeah.
Right, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I think the scene was beautifully written in terms of the writing and the dialogue and the way they read their lines. And for me, it's also, I can imagine that the script was not what they read out. It was used as a sort of base for them to act off.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of interpreted the script and knew who their characters were and then portrayed those words on screen. And for me, that's what great actors can do. Fucking hell, Tobes. You're having a laugh, ain't you? So yeah, for me, that scene was incredible. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder is going to ring true in terms of a line that people will always look back to. And I think the great sign of a great series is when one-liners and sort of memes can come from that, not just through jokes, but like through its sort of just force of nature. And I think chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Definitely does that for me personally. It's a scene full of tension. It builds up slowly. The score comes
into
it.
And the scenery as well.
And obviously, what do you mean by that?
As in like being in the or saying being like right fucking next to the Iron Throne.
The Iron Throne, okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And there's so many scenes where like
when you can actually see it, but it's in the background. Which kind of shows what these two are looking to do. Yeah, yeah.
So sick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well done, well done. It's a great scene. Guys, good start to the episode. What I'm going to do is play a clip from the episode. Hopefully there's no adverts. So what we'll do, we're going to play a quick clip from an episode. We'll discuss why it's in our top 10 and we'll go from there.
So this is number 10?
This is number 10. We'll go from here. So guys, Hard Home. Why is Hard Home, I mean, it's a free floor. Why do you think Hard Home is a top 10 Game of Thrones scene or moment in terms of context within the specific scene and maybe its wider implications on the series?
Paris power.
I think at that point, you obviously knew about the White Walkers and people coming back from the dead. I don't think it was, we knew people came back from the dead at that point, did we?
We did.
We did?
We did, yeah. Well, the first time that we see a White Walker...
No, we see White Walkers, but we didn't see, like, people coming back from dead. I might be wrong, I can't remember.
I think we did.
No, we didn't see the Night King actually use his powers to awaken the dead, though. I think we did.
And the only reason why I say that, okay, is because, obviously, at this point, Jon Snow is with the Wildings. I'm pretty sure they had a few encounters before that.
With White Walkers, yeah?
Yeah.
No, but I'm not saying about White Walkers. I'm talking about people die. And now they rise from the dead.
I think one thing that's safe to say, this is the first time that we see other people being able to witness, so the living witnessing the dead becoming the living again, essentially.
Yeah,
I think that's the first time we see that. And seeing Jon Snow's reaction to the power of the Night King and his ability to awaken the dead. And then this essentially sets the precedent for the rest of the series in terms of what the real force is. Again, the real issue isn't the White Walkers or the Night King, as we come to find out. But everything alludes to this being the big battle beforehand, and I think that's the power of the scene. And I think the other scene beforehand, which is maybe 10 minutes earlier, where Jon Snow's fighting the White. And he used the Valyrian steel.
Yeah.
I think, and that was another moment of like, oh wow, this is a way we can kill these whites. It was a great scene for me. It's a great moment for Game of Thrones. It's great. It's beautifully shot as well.
Yeah. And they kept saying as well, like on the build up to it, I don't remember what the exact number was, but I think it was something like 300,000. It was like, oh, we have 300,000 wildlings here that were trying to do. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the battle started from the other side of like the camp and it came all the way to the gate.
To the shores, yeah, yeah.
You could almost be like, that's at least 200,000 people that are just dead.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you get like the gravity of how big the army is now, you know? And yeah, it's fantastic.
I think also the fact that Jon Snow and the people that are with him, the Night's Watch, are seeing this. And then when Jon Snow goes to report back to people that this is an actual thing, and people still don't believe him, but we're like, believe him, please, listen to what he's saying. And that adds to like the sort of anxiety and the excitement of the series. So yeah, for me, it's a great series. It was beautifully shot. I love the colour grading, which you mentioned before. It's such an eerie sound as well. And obviously, him walking up, and we get a shot of the feet, and just the sound, and it's just silence throughout. Great scene, man. It's a great scene.
Great scene.
Yeah.
Number 10.
That's number 10. Number 9. Guys, for me, I just love this scene. For me.
No. That was your mistake. You should have ripped them all out, root and stem. Leave one wolf alive, and the sheep are never safe.
For me, it's a redemption story for somebody that's been through so much in the show. And it's Arya Stark. It's Arya Stark, man. And obviously, we've got to remember that in season... When is the Red Wedding?
3?
Yeah, season 3.
I think that specific time that when we see the Red Wedding is Arya, she almost gets so close to getting back to her family.
Yeah.
She's so close.
So close.
It's actually proper tragic that she's always close to getting back to her family and something happens. Like the first time, season one, episode nine, mm-hmm. when she gets close to her dad.
Yeah.
And then she has to witness his head getting chopped off. And then the second time she gets close to her family, then she sees her brother's head on a stake.
Yep.
As they parade him around. Yeah, she's always close to getting back to her family.
I think Rob.
Yeah. After the wedding.
So guys, the North remembers Arya Stark killing the Freys. It's one of for me personally one of the most iconic Game of Thrones moments, because it's a redemption story for Arya. It's a moment for her to get retribution. It's also an ability for her to utilize the powers and the skills that she's acquired since she's been away from her family, right? But yeah, talk to me. What are your thoughts on Arya Stark, the North remembers, and her sort of redemption with the Freys?
First of all, fuck with the Frey.
What a piece of shit.
Bro, I think he's the character.
Brilliantly acted, by the way.
Yeah.
An acting performance. Unbelievable.
When you have this level of dislike for a person's character, it comes down to the acting. Amazing performance. He's just like a sniveling coward, isn't it? And obviously, even just spoken about now, how Arya Stark was very much a tragic person throughout most of the Game of Thrones.
Mm.
Constantly seeing her family being killed off. Her being kicked out of home, her having to run away and essentially creating a new life. For her to come back and get the revenge the way that she did.
The way she did it.
The way that she did was phenomenal. The point that my guy is just eating food. And at this point, we don't know that that's her. Because it's the start of the episode,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, start of season, season 7 or 6.
It'll be 5. Not last season.
I believe it's the start of season 6, you know. Let's double check that. But you continue.
Okay, but yeah.
The season when she's now by herself, right? I'm pretty sure it's last season.
It's the start of season 7.
Yeah.
So when she initially kills the Frey, all the Frey, that's the end of season 6. And the start of season 7 is when she kills the whole family.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Okay, so I'm talking about the scene specifically when she kills Will the Frey.
Yeah.
Okay, but yeah, when he's shooting the thing, then when she makes him realise that he's cheating on his own family or his own son.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Spun me. Absolutely spun me.
And they're toasting. And they're having a great time, the family, and yes,
yeah,
for me, it's a great scene. Hoss, any thoughts?
No, just it brought back the shock
shock like, value of your thrones, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. For a long time, okay, there was like a thing where it was like you almost knew what was gonna happen, but it was so epic you didn't care that it wasn't a shock.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But this was like a oh my god. And then we said earlier that it was almost like a finally moment as well, because she done her whole story, her whole plot.
What did you think about that?
I think it was like just, I think we said earlier, I think it was just like written wrong, you know. I think at times when the camera would go to what she's doing, you know, it was almost like, you know, like,
yeah. And a lot of people had issues with the fact that she didn't end up dying, right?
Yeah, I think
when she got stabbed and then she jumped off.
Yeah, like she was badly bruised. She got stabbed. She was getting chased by that other small girl. She wasn't a small girl, but she was a very tiny person. And it's like it just didn't make sense for her to survive with that, and mm-hmm. for her to be fine afterwards. And there was like quite a lot of theories saying that Arya Stark is actually dead and this is somebody else using her face. So yeah, again, with many issues with Game of Thrones in the latter seasons, I don't feel like the execution was great. I feel like it was a good storyline to have, an important storyline to have, especially to expand the world of Game of Thrones. Mm. But she did end up going to Braavos, and then we got to see different cultures, so on and so forth, just to make the world a bit more richer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah, it was cool, but I just felt like the execution wasn't great. Even her escape just felt underwhelming. But she was always going to come back to Westeros, but I just didn't like the way that it was written.
She just ran away.
Yeah, and it felt so unresolved.
There was nothing mm-hmm. special, but she just ran away.
Yeah, it just felt so unresolved. And again, she shouldn't have gotten away in that position. But yeah, that's my issue with it. I feel like good storyline to have, just poorly executed.
Mm. Yeah. Also, even the guy, the guy that was a training heart in Braavos,
the man with no name.
Yeah, it's even like him.
Face God.
It's like, was he the person when she first met him when he was in jail?
Drummer, yeah,
like,
yeah,
kind of stuff, okay. And it's like cool. Like we got no context of that. Why he was kind of like traveling like that, and then he's back now in the temple. Was he looking for her? Was he not looking for her? Was he looking for someone else? Was he looking for people in general? You know,
I agree with you on the context part.
So it was there was no context for it at all. And then like we're almost because he's a mysterious guy. They almost want us to leave it as a mysterious thing.
Yeah.
It's like, well, just
you didn't like the ambiguity of that,
of him in particular. It's like, be ambiguous if we meet you in your ambiguous setting, but we meet you in a very loud setting, in a very in the world setting.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? And why are you helping her out of like everyone? Is it because you know that she's royal blood, but when you also try to convince her to that she's not royal blood, just forget about it. I don't know. It's very
because he's Ned Stark. Did you not see the theories of it back then that he was Ned Stark, that at some point Ned Stark went to Braavos and trained and became a man with no name.
Oh my event. You can say about anyone.
No, but there's, I'm not agreeing with the theory, but it was like there was like people brought up quite a few things, and right before he gets head chopped off, he says a prayer in the book and in the TV show, and someone saying that it wasn't Ned that actually died. Again, not my theory. I don't necessarily agree with it, but yeah.
Thrones had us. Oh, bro, have some crazy theories, man.
That rabbit hole went deep.
Yeah,
it went deep.
Peak, fam.
It wasn't even through Twitter. I was literally just looking.
You must have been on a Reddit thing, bruv.
I was on Twitter.
It wasn't Reddit. It was I think it was mainly YouTube.
YouTube had big theories, man.
Yeah. YouTube, I was watching. You know me. But yeah.
Yeah, man. So next up, number 8.
He's washing down.
If it please your grace, Lady Sansa is very tired.
No, the wait here.
Your grace.
It's nothing.
Guys, talk to me about your thoughts on the Purple Wedding.
Only one good bit in the whole thing.
But possibly the most satisfying bit of...
Exactly.
The whole one of the most satisfying scenes from Game of Thrones.
It's evening. Like busting a nut.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to let you have it. I don't know if we clip that up, but I'm going to let
like,
you have it.
You're having like a mediocre, you know, good time.
It's going to make it worse.
Right. And then as you're doing it, you're doing it. And then it's almost like she says, come for me. And when you hear that, you go, raw, that's crazy. And then done. You know what I'm saying? It's that good... 20 seconds.
This single you concerns me.
Of satisfaction.
Anyways, it's a great scene for the simple fact of how much came before it.
Pause.
It was... Fair enough. It was a build-up of anticipation in terms of when is this guy going to die? Because he had to. I'm sure all of us want him to die, and we thought he was going to. So the way that he died, it was just satisfying. Mm-hmm. And even seeing Cersei's face, the way that she reacted, is like, you hold that.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, so it's one of my favorite scenes.
Cersei's acting, by the way.
My son! Oh, bro, brilliant, up, bro. Brilliant.
You don't care.
I think the first thing we have to do is shout out to Jack Gleeson, who played Joffrey. I think he excelled at depicting one of the most hated characters we've probably come across
ever
in recent years, alongside someone like a Ramsay Bolton, for example. Brilliantly acted as a sort of petulant, up himself. It makes sense that he was born of being his mother and father being brother and sister. It makes perfect sense the way he was. He gave incel vibes.
Facts.
Yeah, now like I think like in like today's age, he would have had some sort of mental condition, fam, psychosis or one of them ones, bro. You know what I'm saying?
But yeah, I think just the joy of seeing him suffer, was the great thing about that scene. And alongside the different reactions, so you got Tywin there, you got Tyrion who has to sort of shuttle off quickly, you got Varys who's involved in a little plotting and scheming. Within this specific scene, there's still a lot of plotting and scheming ongoing, just surrounding it.
You've got Sophie Turner's character, what's her name again?
Sansa.
Sansa's relief, like, this guy's been torturing me for months, like, oh my days, like, thank God he's dead and gone.
Yeah.
And then she has to also, she has to almost trust whoever it is that's going to take her down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's crazy.
And then obviously this leads into one of our sort of, one of our scenes or moments that didn't make the top 10, with obviously this being plotted by Olenna and Peter Baelish.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was sort of alluded to, but until you watch it back, you don't really understand what's going on.
Yeah.
These two characters have been working together. Varys has been sort of plotting and scheming as well. And then obviously Marjorie Tyrell was meant to marry Joffrey. And it just shows the sort of crazy nature of Westeros and Game of Thrones, where as soon as Joffrey died, Marjorie tried to marry off straight away. She was ready to marry her brother.
Everything.
She's trying ready to marry his brother.
Yeah.
Crazy, man.
Tommen's
Baratheon.
You got luck off later.
Who ends up being the next king, and then, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Yeah, man.
Good times.
Any other thoughts on that scene before we move on?
No, I think that scene became a fall off of quite a lot of other great scenes. One that we'll end up speaking of.
Mm-hmm. So, at number 7.
Kill your own father and stand by while thousands of men, women and children burned alive. Would you have done it? Would you have kept your oath then? First I killed the pyromancer, and then when the king turned to flee, I drove my sword into his back.
Manny.
Yes.
I don't know if we should leave the floor to you for this. I know why I think this is a great scene. But you managed to get this to 7.
I did.
You did well, because this wasn't in the top 10. You know why I'm not mad, though? I'm not mad because I think, firstly, Thrones just has so many great scenes. It has so many great moments. It's hard to say there's a definite top 10 of moments. People are going to probably cuss the ras out of us for this. But Jaime and Brienne's scene, in a sense, was very similar to a lot of scenes, but also very different.
Yeah.
But talk to me about your thoughts on Jaime and Brienne's bathtub scene.
Yeah, I think that's one of my favourite character moments in the whole of Game of Thrones for Jaime Lannister specifically. I think before that, we all had opinions of Jaime Lannister. I thought he's a bit of a cunt, essentially. somebody that shags his twin sister, somebody that lacks honour, is somebody that's like selfish and does things for himself. But obviously, throughout the whole journey between with him and Brienne, he showcases that he has a kind of side. And I think the conversation, or him telling Brienne about what actually happened with the Mad King and why he had to kill him, completely changed the perspective of Jaime as a character and who he really is deep down in his core.
And just to not interrupt, but like the way the Mad King was used, as in the what's the actual term for killing the Mad King? They had a term for it, right?
Not Tyrion.
Kingslayer was the title for Jaime Lannister. It was continuously used to sort of belittle him and take away from his character and who he was.
Yeah.
And him adding the context as to why he is the Kingslayer just takes, as you mentioned, I'm not trying to make a different point to you, but it just adds the beautiful context as to summarise this character. He's not all bad.
Yeah.
He's not all good.
And it's so funny, yeah. But do you know, like, he almost says to Brienne, I was reading a, well, this is when I was doing my dive, yeah. Like, I was watching a video, yeah, and a theory is that he was telling her that because, and then a lot of people, they were asking, why didn't he tell this story publicly, right, to people, so they can stop calling him Kingslayer, blah, blah, blah. And then it was like his dad who was ashamed of him publicly was proud of him internally, because his dad's like, yo, you did the right thing, but the fear, people are calling you Kingslayer because they're fearful, right? And the fear of the family that he's a Kingslayer, but we're still in charge of the whole Seven Kingdoms, right? And it was almost as if he was holding that story in, because him sounding like a hero is not the narrative that they want to perceive. You know, is that they want to actually have the Lannister family, right, be so fearful that even if you rule, we can take over. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think that's what he's telling Brienne in the bathtub scene. He's telling her, yo, like, these are the reasons why I had to be a bad guy. I had to be this. You know what I'm saying? And by the way, but when you're, and we know this as like humans, when you're a bad guy for a long time, you almost do become a little bit bad. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's true.
Yeah, no, I'm not disputing.
And you said earlier, you said that, like, he shows his good side when it comes to Brienne, and that, like, his human side. He was showing that with Tyrion a lot of the time, but Tyrion was asking him, are you doing this because I'm your brother and we are Lannisters? Why are you doing this? Because you care for man.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? And that was the confusion. At that point, you understand he was doing it because he cared for him.
Yeah.
100%.
And I think we see that as the series goes on. We see the developing relationship with the two. So
and with the Kingslayer, like, similar to what he said, the Kingslayer title, like, he had to hold it like a rope. You had to, like, showcase they had it, but you can tell that it was weighing him down. And that moment with Brienne, I feel like that's what the first time that we actually seen Jaime for who he is.
Yeah.
You had to let that go and be vulnerable. And the acting within it, which, like, again, like we spoken earlier, you can't fault the acting throughout the whole of Game of Thrones. And in that particular scene, like, raw, bro, like, this is who you are, really and truly. So I love that scene. It's literally my favorite character.
It's so funny, yeah. You could arguably say, okay, that now, from that scene now onwards, Brienne is the only person in the world
that knows Jaime.
That knows Jaime.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, and she barely says anything. You know, but she sits there and she's like this. Her eyes are open, but she's such a shock. And the fact that it happens in a bath scene, a hot bath scene, is hilarious, because it's like the relaxation of it is, now I can let go.
Yeah,
you know,
It's kind of coupled with another scene that Jaime has with what's her name, the mum,
Catelyn Stark.
Catelyn Stark, when Jaime gets captured. And then Catelyn Stark is in a cage, and obviously trying to negotiate with him in terms of getting the release of Sansa, or for him to look after Sansa while she's gone. And he says something to her in terms of, because one thing about Jaime, like, even the whole Kingslayer thing, is that he lacks honor. That's why he's a Kingslayer. But obviously that's not the case. And even the whole thing with his sister, and his thing was that she's the only woman that I've ever loved. She's the only woman that I actually care for. So it's not me that lacks honor. It's Ned that lacks honor because he has a son of another woman. Obviously, we find out later that's not to be the case. But again, it kind of couples in with the conversation that he had with Brienne in terms of the perspective people have of Jaime and what he does and the shitty things that he does. But internally, who he actually is as a person, they'll look at him as a Kingslayer, somebody that commits incest, disgusting stuff. But in his heart of hearts, he's not a dishonorable person, because he doesn't feel like what he's doing is actually dishonorable. He didn't feel like the king's killing the king was dishonorable. It was actually saving lives. The only reason why he has feelings for his sister, that's why he is the way he is. But yeah, it's just like a great great scene to add depth into a character that could have gone to be one dimensional if he didn't have these emotional scenes.
Good point. And I think just with that scene, one of the things I noted down was the fact that obviously they're in a bathtub and they're both naked, and essentially they're both laying themselves unintentionally, I guess, they're laying themselves bare to each other.
Yeah.
And then him being in the bathtub is his opportunity to also, when he's detailing the information about the Mad King, he's cleansing himself, both metaphorically and physically. So I think I really enjoyed the fact that, if you look at the scene as well, one of the details I noticed was Jaime is actually very dirty in the bathtub, unkept. Yeah. And if you look at the scene with Brienne, she's brightly lit, she's cleansed. And it's essentially showing the difference in the perception of the characters at that specific time. And this scene was his opportunity to finally sort of cleanse himself. And
he also had enough. At that point, he was tortured, bro. He was taken through the ringer, fam. You know what I mean? Like,
And he slowly but surely gets angrier in the scene. Like, the tension in himself starts to rise as he starts to recount the story, because I think he's sick and tired of the perception of himself. Also understands that it's a necessary perception, but he's sick and tired of being treated this way because he's killed the Mad King, when the Mad King was actually the Mad King. You know what I'm saying?
One of the most satisfying arcs is Jamie's character in the whole series.
One of the most what, sorry?
Satisfying arcs.
Up until a point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm totally with you, by the way. Yeah. Totally with you. Next up. And number six.
For the watch. For the watch. For the watch.
Another debated one. We moved it up and down the list. The murder of Jon Snow, otherwise known as For the Watch.
I think this is a PR pick, right? I'm not mad at it. Okay, I think we've picked this because of what it done for the series, like.
And what do you think it did? What do you think it did for the series commercially?
I think it made all of the non-watchers watch. You know, I think it made everybody that like us, man, that were like, you got to watch Game of Thrones. Oh my god! It gave a public reaction. It even gave, like, I remember it was some Kit
Harington.
Yeah, it's the first time now he's going on like Jimmy Kimmel.
Press runs, right?
The press run off, like, because obviously they're like, yo, you dead, nigga, and he's like, yeah, trust me. Fantastic. Like the way that they played all of that year was just so good on camera and off camera, right? Mm-hmm. And it's almost like they paint this thing for him in that scene, okay, that he dies because the same reason why Ned died, because he's so honourable to the T, and he's so blind with, like, kind of, like,
literally mirrored season 1 episode 9 where Ned Stark dies, in a sense.
Literally. And for all for the same reasons and stuff, okay? But then when, obviously, like, I'm pairing the scene when he comes back to life. Because when he comes back to life, it's almost as if Ned came back to life, he'd be like, all right, cool. Do you know what? I'm not going to... I've now learned how not to be around these people who can't be trusted. Mm-hmm. It's not about honour. It's about survival, right? Do you know what I'm saying? And John, after that, became about survival. But that scene in particular, just the fact that he was so loyal to everyone there, even that stupid kid that stabbed him. Do you remember that kid, bro?
Ollie, yeah.
Ollie, waste man, bro. Fuck that guy, fam. He brought you from the dirt, bruv.
Mm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
And it's just, and it just, yeah. And obviously, like, they killed his dog as well. His dire wolf. And obviously, as we know, for a long time, every time a dire wolf dies, then one of the family dies. So it was like, all right, cool, here we go. But yeah, no, I just thought it was just an iconic scene of what it done on and off camera.
The treacherous Night Watch, man.
Yeah.
Manny, anything?
Yeah, I really liked the scene, especially because it came right at the end of, was it season 4? Right at the end.
Season 5.
Came right at the end. And I think Huss mentioned this off mic, like, it was at a point where the books were finishing. So the amount of theories, again, I love theories. One of the great things about Game of Thrones and the community itself, when it was active and we were talking about it, but so many theories in terms of, like, so many people predicted the fact that it was coming back and how it was going to come back. Mm-hmm. It was through, what's her name?
Lady Melisandre.
Thank you, my guy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was excited for the next season. I don't think a season ending of Game of Thrones had me more excited for the next season, apart from that one. More than that one.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
So yeah, man, it was a great scene. And for the watches, I made a few jokes out of it, but yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, yeah, for real. So next up at number 5. Of course, this is like your magnus opus. Is that how you say it? Is it magnus opus?
No, yeah? No, I have no idea.
No?
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I'm right. Yeah, I'm glad, man. Thank you. this is. But you wanted this higher, I believe.
I want this in the top 3.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Battle of Bastards.
Battle of the Bastards. An iconic moment in Game of Thrones, season 6, episode 9. And as we know with Game of Thrones, what they tend to do is with the penultimate episode is normally the biggest episode. It might not always be a battle, but something significant always happens within the episode 9 of the 10 episodes. Why is this a number 5 contender for you? Why should it be higher for you? Mm-hmm. Interestingly, talk to me about this scene for you.
I'm a big war guy, and I think we said,
and you're always cussing Jason.
By the way, I'm a big war guy. Full stop is crazy status.
And just to note, one of our cast members has never watched Game of Thrones, but he watches House of the Dragon. So fucking...
I hate him.
How fucking weird is that?
I hate him.
It's so weird. Like, he's still restricting himself from greatness. Because House of the Dragon is good.
It's almost like not living in London and living in, like, MK. You just restrict yourself from greatness. But no, that...
Do you know what it's like? It's like watching... No, that's harsh. I was going to say it's like watching the TASM films. I know watching the Sam Raimi films. Like, that's too far. It's too far. It's way too far. House of the Dragon doesn't compare to TASM.
Yeah,
it's too far.
You've stabbed him.
Yeah, I avoid it.
But yeah, no, that scene for me, like, you know, like going off like films like Lord of the Rings and that stuff, which obviously we know that the series is inspired by heavily, and that kind of stuff, like the way that like for example, like the maps for Game of Thrones are inspired solely by
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. The way that the maps are done, and the intro, he took it from Lord of the Rings. It's fucking sick. But yeah, so just like little stuff like that, okay, like, and watching that for a long time be like the penultimate like high of like fantasy war films, mm-hmm. right? And then to see that one, and it's hilarious because it's probably the more grounded one, you know, out of all the ones that we saw throughout the 7 seasons, it's probably the most grounded battle.
It's the most true depiction of war I think we've had.
100%. Because the rest of them had wildfire and it had fucking the dragons and it had like, you know, like different things.
This is all out war.
This is all out war, like status, 4-4 status, do you know what I'm saying? I mean, even the preparation for the scene that we're about to talk about, where he goes to, like, you know, different towns, whatever, okay, and calls for everybody, yo, Ned Stark, yo, back me, da da da, and then they're like, bruv, you were just part of Night's Watch, why are you here? And then he's like, I just died, nigga. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm good, like, I died for the watch, you know? So, yeah, like, all of that, and then obviously getting to the front line, having half the men that they thought they were going to have, mm-hmm. and the kind of the whole plan, and they were saying it in the, wasn't the tent was, we'll stay by the tree line when they come in, and when they come and hit us, we'll try to pick them off, okay, as best we can, okay, so we can hide kind of like our like full numbers, blah blah blah. And then Ramsay being the tapped person that he is, and Sansa even saying in the war room, do not underestimate me, man. She was so shook, mm-hmm. She's standing there like she's so shook, like, you man are talking as if he's not a fucking lunatic. Do you know what I mean? Okay, it's just the build up was just...
And I think you see Jon Snow sort of somewhat ignorance just in terms of who...
Oh, 100%. Yeah. He was like, no, he's like, he's just a man. Do you know what I mean? It's like, bro, this guy's tapped. And then, boom, obviously, like, we see the scene where his little brother, who...
runs in a straight line.
He runs
Rickon Stark.
Yeah. Runs in a straight line.
We interviewed
line.
The actor that played him for Alex Ryder.
Shout out to him. We should ask, bro. Why are you running in a fucking straight line for, bro? The kid. But this, and then you know, Ramsay just, you know, being like, yeah, go feedback to him, and they're shooting him. And I almost think that he was missing on purpose. You know what I mean? The first.
Like, oh yeah, manipulation.
Yeah, no, I think it was. Yeah, manipulation.
He was definitely missing on purpose. But the way that John forgot he was a leader of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just literally jumped on a horse solo, ran, and then...
Just show the true emotion, right?
The true emotion, because he just took all his generalship out of the way.
Yeah, yeah,
he was
like,
well, let me go. And,
see the man for who he is.
Exactly. And then, like, as he misses him, and then he's like, holding him, and then they all charge.
Mm-hmm.
And even this, the guy... Who's the guy, by the way, that tells them to charge? I love him as well. The pirate guy.
Davos.
Davos? Is it Davos?
Yeah, Davos is a pirate.
Yeah. Davos. The way he looks at it, and he's so upset with what's happened. He doesn't even know the different kid, but he's just like, go, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And then, obviously the best part is that he's looking down, and then he looks up. What's his name? Camera pans back. Holds out the sword,
and the camera sort of pans behind his back
back.
We see his perspective of what he sees. Yeah,
it's a wide shot. Everyone's coming towards him, and then the camera quickly pans right to the middle on the side shot, and then before he can even swing once, everyone, boom,
chaos,
and just chaos. And then
it showed the true grim nature of war in its like rawest form. And obviously we know there's a sort of some of the factor of Jon Snow had the sort of superhero luck where, not superhero luck, but you know that sort of fortune, oh, I guess, where really and truly, Jon, you should be dead, brother. Like, you shouldn't be.
You should have time ago.
But I can somewhat take myself out of that and just appreciate the overall depiction of war, the grey, grim, wet, dirty nature of that specific war.
Bro, the horses flying across.
The horses flying, the swords, it's
didn't have to put out a statement saying like no horses were harmed.
Oh, yeah. Fair done.
Because a few people complaining, oh, you're not killing horses.
Okay, man. Didn't know, man. Fascinating stuff.
But absolutely breathtaking scene.
Yeah, man. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Cool. Number four. For me, this is a contender for a top three. Personally, I'm not upset that it's fourth.
To be fair, fourth means that it was a contender. Yeah.
But like a serious contender.
Mm.
Cersei blowing up the set. Iconic.
What a scene, man. Nah, great scene.
Yeah.
Haunting scene. The score builds up the tension beautifully. It kind of explored for me, one of the notes I made, is how faith and religion can blind you to what's right in front of you.
Yeah.
And we see that through the High Sparrow, who doesn't believe that Cersei's capable or she has the means.
Well, because he's winning. the whole season, he's winning.
So this is where I think it's I guess, a mixture of both, where he's blinded by his arrogance and he's also blinded by his sort of faith and belief in who he is and his convictions and what's sort of worked for him to get him to where he currently was in terms of the power that he acquired, right?
Yeah.
The tension through the score is just it. Yeah. The score hits you inside, man. One of the other notes I made was the use of like the lighting in specific scenes, especially some of those darker scenes where Lancel Lannister is crawling and you see the candle at the far end, and then obviously the lighting of the wildfire as well. Great scene, man. What are your thoughts, lads? Talk to me.
Brilliant film, brilliant scene. The score is definitely something that sticks out for me the most, because it just builds up so much anticipation throughout.
Yeah.
And even when you're watching it, and there's so many menaces that's happened in Game of Thrones, you still didn't expect that to be the consequences of what Cersei wanted to do.
Yeah.
And even the acting with, I don't know her name, the one that plays Marjorie
Tyrell.
The one that plays Marjorie Tyrell.
Shout out to Marjorie.
Like she intensifies the scene just by her acting and her urgency in terms of wanting to get people out, because throughout most of it she's very calm, she's very collected, and she's very like
she also,
in control.
She also embodies her mother, or oh, sorry, her
grandmother.
Her grandmother, yeah. Yeah. Played by Natalie Dormer.
Yeah, but she embodies her ever so slightly, not as cunning and as experienced as her.
Yeah,
but she definitely knows the game.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And we said earlier in the Purple Wedding, where she moved in quickly. You know what I mean, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, because she knows the game.
She's playing the Game of Thrones.
She's playing Game of Thrones. Okay, she's just like a first year or like a rookie. You know, okay. but she knows the game. But she knows Cersei's a lot more seasoned. You know what I mean? And even in that season as well, yeah, she almost feels like, wait, Cersei's down. I can step up here.
Yeah.
Right? In this game and learn from her. And I think Cersei...
And she used Tommen beautifully.
She used him fantastically. And Cersei, like, in that point as well, why I say she was losing is because she was losing on all sectors. She was losing her son. She was losing herself. She was losing... She was losing
the title. She was losing her people.
Everything. Yeah. Losing everything.
She was losing power.
Losing complete, but also, and yeah, it's just, yeah, sorry.
Correct. Yeah, and for her to go to that extreme, because she was losing everything, was it says his character. And when it happens, like, of course you would do something like this, but nobody else would have done it. Nobody else would have gone to that extreme apart from Cersei in that moment, and just fits her character brilliantly. And everything that we already spoke about is just more so the anticipation for me, the build up to that scene. It's like something is going to happen, like, as soon as but you didn't expect it to be that massive, but yeah, brilliant scene.
One thing I also loved about the scene is, firstly, the way the wildfire lights up Lancel's eyes.
Yeah.
Second was being the sort of delayed moment where it takes a second for the wildfire to actually reach those in the sept, to reach Margaery and the High Sparrow and so on. And then Margaery's like, and then lastly, like when we see the bell drop and hit some of the civilians and it hits the people in West.
It was so unnecessary, but it just added so much gruesome and
horror. It makes it a much more like horrorsome scene, if that's even a word. We can make words up, we're a podcast. Top three.
Let's go.
Top three. Guys, how did we feel about this one being third?
Stripped of all titles and powers, he would serve the realm in permanent exile. And my Lady Sansa has begged mercy for her father. But they have the soft hearts of women. So long as I am your king, treason shall never go unpunished. Sir Illyn, bring me his head.
The death of Ned Stark. How did we...
I think it was more of a status thing. I don't think it was a scene, dramatic thing. I think it was more of a... we all struggled to get through the first season, or the first few
This was episodes. The iconic moment.
This is the moment that all of our subconsciously went...
Okay, I'm in. Yeah. You got me.
It's a scene that took anybody that watched Game of Thrones by surprise, because if you haven't watched a series where the perceived protagonist...
He was in all the posters.
Yeah.
He was in all the marketing. Mm-hmm. He was the lead guy for it, blah, blah, blah. It was mad, bro. And he was the only person in a lot of the posters.
Yeah.
He was the only Don, bro. And because he was arguably the biggest actor in the scene. Do you know what I'm saying? Yes. Yeah, he was in Lord of the Rings. He was in, obviously, different things, so which he dies on them, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
He's got a bad history of it. But yeah, I think just the set pace of it was just everything, so yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of laid the foundation in terms of what Game of Thrones is about. I can't remember what episode it was on, but when Cersei says, if you played the Game of Thrones, you either win or you die.
I think it's like 3 or 4. I think it's early doors.
Yeah, it was fairly on, which set the tone in terms of this is what you're watching. This is the series that's about. Hence why I get so annoyed about the other stuff that happens with Jon Snow.
It's so funny though, because around episode 7, 8, he starts playing the game, but he plays it too late.
Yeah,
because what he's doing is that he's got his warriors, right? So he's got his like crew from his ends, right, and that kind of stuff. But then what he's not clocking is that man has to come to new ends and
play different rules
and pick people from this ends that I can trust. That's why he went to Littlefinger, and that's why he went to thingy. He actually chose Littlefinger over Varys. Do you know what I mean? Okay, because obviously he knew that Littlefinger loved his wife, so he was like, okay, you know what, he might just back me just because of that. Do you know what I'm saying? Whereas actually, in theory, he should have trusted Varys a little bit more.
Varys was there to... He's a master manipulator.
But he was shook at him, bro. Like, Ned was like, yo, fuck that guy. Like, from early, he was like, you and your little birds, and fuck you, bruv. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm saying is that he played the game. He just played it wrong. He just played it wrong.
The thing is, yeah, at that point that you got to, yeah, he done dumb shit. But at that point, it should have been fine. The only issue was Joffrey, he's just a madman. Because even Cersei was like spun.
She was shocked.
She was spun. It's like, why would you do that?
And arguably, like Cersei's thought process, she was more shook of her dad at that point, because she was like, she definitely thought about the wider war. Like, oh my god, wait a minute, we now have a disadvantage. But obviously, that's why they went and got thingy Sansa, right? Because she now became what they had in plan for Ned Stark. The plan was to make Ned Stark the example, take care of Sansa, blah blah blah. Then when he dies, Sansa almost becomes this image of torture. And they're still treating her semi-well to be the wife. Do you know what I mean? It's crazy.
Yeah, because also, she still holds the name of a Stark.
She still holds.
It's still family ties. It's still politics. It's still where we want to be the family, and the Starks are still a prominent family.
Exactly.
We can use Sansa as sort of, what's the word? Oh, they were using Sansa as like
a bargaining chip.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's nuts, because like Rob would have gone, I think anyway, or I think he says it once, I think if his dad was still alive, they would have charged at King's Landing immediately. That would have been the plan.
Yeah,
you go from there straight to King's Landing. Now that also they have Sansa and he's dead.
It's and like, they don't know where Arya is at the point. So they think Arya's still under the
exactly. Yeah. So then their whole strategy changes. Like, all right, cool. We can't go straight there because they're threatening to kill them off immediately. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Now they could already be dead. So instead of we going to King's Landing and because they were going there with the theory of saving Ned and then the whole of the North says Ned's still alive, let's back it.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, okay, Rob had to go on a journey to prove himself to all the other man them, like, yo, you might come back me. Yeah. So he had to fight like what, 3 or 4 battles before everyone blindly said he's the King of the North. Yeah. All right, cool. He had to become the King of the North to have the rallying crew to get to that point. Whereas if his dad was still alive, he wouldn't have had to do that because his dad is the King of the North, right? Okay. Yeah. So they would have been like, yo, he's still there. Yeah. Let's go.
One thing that scene also adds for Cersei and Joffrey is that I think from that moment we realise that Cersei can't control Joffrey.
Yeah.
And he literally will do whatever he wants. But yeah, great scene.
And the last thing I love about that scene is before Ned Stark's head gets chopped off, we kind of hear a silence, and I think it's a silence in him where he's somewhat, finally, he understands he's at peace because he knows his life is going. I'm going to assume he's at peace anyway. And then it's just complete silence where we just hear him breathing, and then it's a realisation of his life going. We also get the reaction of Arya Stark, and we hear the silence, the sword boom. And it's just the birds fluttering.
And you see when he was looking as well, when it was like silent and stuff, the camera kept panning to like people like screaming, like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, yeah. Traitor.
And he's just looking like, wait a minute, is this how I'm going out? As like a traitor, the person that had all this fucking honor, had all this fucking thing, I'm known for it. Like, this is my brand. You know what I mean? And he's just looking like, raw. Like, this is crazy. Do you know what I mean? And yeah, boom. I think he was just more sad to leave his daughters where they were than anything, you know. I think he was always willing to die at the right time. But yeah,
interesting. What a moment for a series. It's a series defining moment, easily.
Yeah, 100%.
Number two.
Yes, sir.
I wish I was the monster you think I am. I wish I had enough poison for the whole pack of you. I would gladly give my life to watch you all swallow it.
Zimmerman!
Tyrion, courtroom speech.
Yes, sir.
Manny.
Be my lawyer.
The acting, the dialogue.
Peter Dinklage.
Shout out to you, Peter Dinklage. I think that is the best
acted scene.
Monologue in the whole of
Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Okay, talk to me.
Obviously, this is on the fallout of the proper wedding after Joffrey gets killed, and we don't know who did it, but we know it's not Tyrion. But obviously, Cersei and Tywin just want to get Tyrion out of here, so they put the blame on him. So it doesn't matter who killed Joffrey, Cersei will always blame Tyrion for some reason. And I can't remember why Tywin was more. I know Tywin always hated Tyrion because obviously his birth killed his wife.
No, it's because the episode before, Tyrion slaps Joffrey, and then also he threatens to kill him. He actually threatens to fucking kill him. It was because it was at the point where Sansa is now Tyrion's wife to be, and then like he sets up from like she's not yours to play around anymore, da da da, and then like he threatens him, and then she says that, okay, she's like, oh, it's Tyrion, you saw how he was, da, da, da. That's how they got to the bill, where she used that little excuse here to be like, ah, she always wanted him dead.
The court scene where he just reads everybody in that room for filth, and even the line when he says something like, I didn't kill Joffrey but I wish that I did, the passion in that speech. But yeah, man, it's just great acting, and the writing for it which is brilliant. It's that simple, is why I just love that scene. It's like probably my favorite scene of Game of Thrones.
I think what the great thing about this scene is some of the lines that he says, like where he said, she says, I wish I was the monster that you think I am, like,
yeah,
the way you've treated me. And I think that was a letter to his family more so than like, obviously it was a letter to the people of King's Landing.
It was
also a specific letter to his family. He said, I wish I was the monster that you thought I was. I wish I'd killed Joffrey. I think the last one he says, I've been on trial my entire life. So this is nothing to me because you've treated me like I'm some criminal my entire life. Go on.
And even how he ends it.
Oh, you'd have to remind me.
It says that oh, I know I won't get justice here, so I want a trial by combat.
I was spun.
Mm. And then obviously we get find out that speech is just great. It's great, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great scene. And then obviously that all leads to him escaping and killing his dad.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Always taking the shit out.
Always in the shit.
Taking the shit out.
If fuck this girl, by the way.
Yeah.
Piece of shit.
Can't trust hoes, man.
Oh, boy.
He's a
heartbreak anniversary.
What a tune. And we have at number one, I think this is undisputed. Mm-hmm. I think we all agreed.
Yeah.
We all agreed.
Or I will cut your wife's throat.
I'll find another. Mother. The Lannisters send their regards.
Do you know what I love about scenes like this, yeah? We're now in the era of reaction videos, right? So, like, people...
Oh, that shows are hilarious.
So we'll see people, like, watching Thrones for the first time, and they'll be reacting to scenes like when Ned Stark dies, or they'll be reacting to Joffrey dying. For me, the reaction... Anytime I see somebody reacting to this specific scene of the Red Wedding, it's gold, just content for me, man. And I really, really do enjoy watching that. The first time I saw this episode, or this moment in the scene, shall I say, I was caught off guard. The more I watched it, the more I kind of enjoyed it. I'll be so honest with you, and it sounds tapped. I kind of enjoyed this scene a bit more. The first time you watch it, naturally, you're a bit like, "What the fuck have I just watched?"
Yeah.
What the fuck have I just watched?
Yeah.
But as I've like used to rewatch Thrones like every year now, because you know the new season coming out.
Yeah.
I was like, "Man, this is a fucking great scene."
Yeah.
And it's the moment where one of the soldiers of Walder Frey, I believe, or the Boltons, I don't know which one he's working for, but he walks towards the door and shuts the door, and the music starts playing.
Reza Casimir.
And then we see Catelyn Stark's reaction. She's like,
"Oh, God,
what's going on here?" Yeah. But talk to me, guys, man.
And Rob has no idea.
How's it like? Because he's an idiot, man. I'm sorry.
Why do you think he's an idiot?
So
here we go.
And this is why I love the fact that he's dead, because. Because again, we spoke about the premise of Game of Thrones. Like, you ever play the Game of Thrones or you die.
Right.
And he kept doing dumb shit. And one of the dumb shit that he did is that you promised that you were going to marry one of Walder Frey's daughters.
Mm. And she was for that world, she would have been deemed as fire.
Yeah.
Because Edmund, Catelyn's brother,
ends up
marrying
her. Yeah.
And he was like, "Rah, you're kind of clean."
Yeah. Mm. But even, I get it, you find the love of your life, and you ended up marrying her.
And everyone told him she's a stunner.
Yeah, you know, but he could have just had her as a mistress, bro. You made a promise. You made a deal.
It's facts.
And that deal was pivotal in terms of your war campaign.
Alliances, man.
Alliances to get, because you needed a bridge to cross over. You don't do it, bro. There's going to be consequences. So for the consequences to end up being, as you mentioned, the build up to Reza Casimir playing in the background, and then Catelyn Stark pulling the sleeve or Bolton's sleeve and seeing armor underneath it, it's gonna get cracking. I don't want to say too much because I feel like you got something to say.
No, go.
Okay, but yeah, and then the scenes kicks off with essentially all of them getting slaughtered, and Rob just standing there in shock at everything that's going on, because I think he has some of his soldiers run as well.
His wife gets that first, right? I'm pretty sure.
No.
I'm pretty sure they stabbed the baby first.
Because they stabbed the...
Yeah.
Was it first?
Yeah, I think it was baby first, you know. I could be wrong. I don't know. Well, go on.
Nah, but soldiers first, then baby, then Rob, then Catelyn kills herself.
Yeah. Because Catelyn has the guy... She doesn't kill herself. She has the guy, and then she was like, "Oh, if you don't
she let..." She kills the daughter.
It was the daughter. It was the daughter. Said, if you don't let Rob go, I'll kill her. And then just kill Rob, slits it, then she dies afterwards. But yeah, it's completely chaotic.
No. Rob was already down. They said, "If you don't let us leave now." Because Bob, also Rob was down. He was stabbed already, everything. And then she grabs also him with her daughter, okay, puts it up, okay, and says, "Well, let us leave now. Just let us leave. Me and Rob, if you let us leave, da 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 da." And then he got stabbed again. Because at this point, he's down. He's bedbody, but he's looking at his his yeah. wife, and he's just like this. He's just in bad shock, and then obviously Bolton comes. They kill Rob Avant.
Bro, completely chaotic. But
and her scream.
Oh yeah, yeah, killed, yeah, 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 yeah.
She killed the daughter, and she it's so funny, yeah, because she killed the daughter knowing that she's not going to get anything out of this. But she's done it because it's the last thing she can do. And
yeah,
she
went, she had to let something
and
off.
She, yeah, and she went ah, and then crazy.
I think what's so good about this scene, yeah, and we can react as we watch it, and we'll clip it up as we said, is that we're seeing, like, in first person, her reaction to seeing the treachery, because she thought at the time that the Boltons were on her side, right? And I think that's the great thing about this scene. I think another great thing about this scene was seeing Arya also almost so close to being back to her family, yep. like, reunited, and it's taken away from her. And that's the great thing about Thrones, like, it gives you hope of, like, sort of reconciliation and family and unity, and then it takes it away. It takes away from the characters, and it takes away from you as a viewer.
The whole journey as well. Yeah. It was mad. And then obviously the Hound come back to grab her and that.
Bro, crazy, crazy moment. Yeah. And when she actually gets stabbed in the belly, you almost feel it yourself.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It's horrible.
And I think the gruesome nature, this is where we see the true nature of Walder Frey, and we see his lack of care for literally anybody, anyone in his vicinity other than himself. Doesn't care about his sons, doesn't care about his daughters. It's all about self-preservation. The series is all about self-preservation. And he was playing the Game of Thrones. That Walder Frey was legit playing the Game of Thrones. He didn't care that was that a potential wife or daughter of his. Daughter, right?
Yeah.
Didn't care. And Catelyn Stark's at her last wits. She's at her, let us go, please, give us the chance to escape. He don't give a shit. Does not care one bit. What a scene, man.
Yeah, but
iconic. Go on.
We've been knowing that Walder Frey's a piece of shit from the time he impregnates his daughters.
Yeah. You're not wrong at all.
But yeah, great, brilliantly
acted Rob, character.
What's wrong?
And I remember the reactions like from Twitter after it happened and all the memes. Everybody was just in complete shock because.
Ah, and it's Roose Bolton.
Yeah,
it's Roose Bolton.
And the thing is that with Game of Thrones, like so many shocking things happen. They just continue to throw it at you and you still get surprised.
And the scream, man.
Yeah.
That's a huge scream. And that's it. Yeah, man. What an amazing scene. Game of Thrones.
Wait.
So someone comes across and...
Crazy.
What? Wow. Honestly, man. Oh, the camera angle was always actually...
And the lighting.
Yeah. You know, in the book, what's the name... Rob's wife doesn't die.
Interesting.
Really?
She escapes pregnant. Yeah.
Game of Thrones.
I think Catelyn comes back.
Yeah.
As I don't even
Lady
know.
Lady Stoneheart?
Yeah. There you go. It's like a spirit, someone on the lines.
Mad too.
Wow, Game of Thrones, man.
But yeah.
That was our top 10 Game of Thrones moments of all time. Please do let us know what you think about our top 10. Drop us some comments, drop us some replies. Engage with our content. It's great content, so make sure you're there to sort of engage with what we've got to put out. Guys, we'll do a quick catch-up just about some things we've been watching maybe, and then we'll wrap up the episode. Hoss, you watched Furiosa, a Mad Max saga?
Yeah.
What'd you think about it?
I enjoyed it, not as much as Fury Road. With Tom Hardy and Charlize
Theron.
Yeah, for Theron and that. But I did actually super enjoy it. You know, I thought it was cinematic. The whole point of the Mad Max series is pure action. Pure action, pure rage, pure cinematic, the angles, the...
Right.
Like, the lighting, like, everything to do with the series from back in the day till now has always been more about... just how it looks and not too much about like the dialogue and, you know what I mean, the plot and stuff. There is obviously a like they gave Furiosa more of a story than the previous
This film's about Furiosa's revenge plot, right?
Yes. And the context of the Fury Road, you know, which we don't get for what we get sort of, but we don't get like the depth of it. And then we never get like context of the place of abundance or paradise,
right?
Per se, and obviously we got that in the first scene, and it feels like they're gonna carry on this story after that because we obviously get the scene of the abundance, but then we don't get anything else after that. So, yeah. So, but yeah, we also know how Mad Max Fury Road ends. But yeah, I do think I like it when franchises that are so kind of vague have these spin-offs where it's like a Mad Max story or something. I like that. I prefer that sometimes to sequels or like prequels and that kind of stuff. Even this one was a prequel.
It was a prequel, yeah.
Yeah. And then obviously I love the way they've done it. Instead of doing a post-credit scene, they done the whole thing where it just leads straight into the Fury Road film, which I thought was pretty sick. overall, if I'm going to rate it, just to be quick, it's a 6.5.
It's highly rated, though. A lot of people have been raving about the film. I was underwhelmed, but that's not to say it wasn't a good film. I really enjoyed some aspects of it. I enjoyed the action scenes. I enjoyed the way the camera moved. George Miller did really well to sort of capture the moments where some of the action scenes or just particular moments of like individual character moments like Furiosa, where she's reacting to something. The camera's just very creative in the movement. And I also loved Anya Taylor-Joy. I thought she was great. I loved the way she sort of acted with her eyes. Didn't need to say much. I've really noticed that there's three or four times that I've seen her recently, she's not had to say much in her scenes, but she's a very good actor with just being quite stoic and like expressive with her eyes and her face.
Yeah.
And I think she excelled in sort of depicting the anguish, the pain, the anger of a young child who's been snatched away from her mother.
I loved Hemsworth, man.
I didn't dislike it.
I loved Hemsworth.
I just didn't think it worked for me tonally. But people loved it, and I'm not going to say.
I think towards the third, fourth act, I think he was written awfully. But I think the first and second act, I think he was very menacing. I think he was very strategic with what he was doing and that kind of stuff. And that actually brought a sense of like knowledge to that mad world.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Not mad at you.
And then I think afterwards he just became kind of an idiot. And then, and then he was brought back in the last scene when he was kind of like on the floor and he's explaining to her, like, we're the same.
Okay.
You know, and that kind of stuff. And I think that brought him back to kind of like nice writing. But yeah, like, I thought overall as a character, he was solid. And she was absolutely fantastic. The guy that was in the car with her, didn't really like him.
Joe Pateri.
I thought he was written very softly. There was no context as to how he became the person that he was on Fury Road.
Come back.
He almost like we didn't know whether it was like a little brother thing or
it was a romance. It was a
eventually
thing. Yeah.
When they like it was weird. You know what I mean? Especially that she was so young. As well at the time, and it was just like, I don't know what's going on, you know what I mean? I didn't like the way he was written. I thought his character was fucking so sick. You know when he was sitting in the car with Bear Times, and like he's just like everything's happening, and he's just like, it was so smooth, you know what I mean? But again, I think the film was more just about the camera angles and the action part of it and the explosions and everything. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Manny, anything you want to discuss before round up?
I've been watching Insecure.
Oh yeah, go off. You've been having a fucking great time.
Having a great time. I'm on season 4 of Insecure. I've been watching it for the first time. So many people have been raving and ranting about it, and I fucking love it. It's really good.
Good.
Great. Have you seen it?
Nope.
Great show. Great character writing. Some of my favorite character writing for a TV show. The characters feel honest and very relatable. Like I can watch the show and be reminded of people that I've met in my life or been the situations that I've been in my life. It's a great show. When
romantic situations out of interest?
Yeah, there's quite a few. In my experience. Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
I knew what I was doing there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. There's one particular scene, like I think it was in season 1 or season 2, where my guy's in splits up with his girl in there. My guy's in the strip club. And obviously the girl's the one that fucked up. And then it's like in the strip club, it's like, I don't even want to be around these other babes. And then he ends up ringing up his ex. He's like, yeah, I've been there. But yeah, so like, yeah, great TV, love it. By the time we record the next episode, I would have finished it, so I'll do a proper deep dive then.
Cool. Just got some news from Marvel, which will interest yourself, I guess. Marvel have announced they're dividing their divisions into 3, essentially. So we're going to have Marvel Animation for shows such as What If and X-Men 97, which has proven to be the highest rated Marvel project ever, X-Men 97.
Mm-hmm. And they said that Marvel Animation will have a sub-tie to the MCU. Okay, so cool. It won't be completely tied, but it can be tied.
So yeah, so then we'll have Marvel Television for shows such as Agatha All Along, Daredevil Born Again, Ironheart, Loki Season 1 and 2 would fall under that as well, WandaVision. And then we're going to have Marvel Studios for the films. So there is essentially, the purpose of this is to make audiences feel as though that they can dip in and out of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Correct, yeah. I think they saw with Phase 4, audiences found it tough at times to keep up with everything going on from films to shows and shows to films. So for example, WandaVision led into the Multiverse of Madness, Loki Season 1 fed into Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania, which then fed into Loki Season 2. We had Miss Marvel, which fed into the Marvels, and I think audiences did find it somewhat tough. Personally for me, not so tough, but I fully understand why people would be like, this is so hard to keep up
if you're a passive watcher, innit?
And more so if it's not good content, I hate the word content for film and TV anyway, if it's not great storylines and great characters and people I'm really interested in, this makes it so much more harder for me to just keep up with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So they're essentially saying that going forward, these divisions will make it easier. The animations will just be animations. It's tied into the MCU in terms of universes, but the storylines aren't linear. We're going to have the television shows, which are going to be somewhat more separate from the MCU live studio action films. And then we're going to have Marvel Studios for the films. And hopefully audiences can enjoy the products going forward. And then we're going to have Marvel Spotlight for one-off shows. So Echo is a one-off show. And Wonder Man's going to be a one-off show as well with Yaha Abdul-Mateen II, who's going to play Wonder Man. I really like him as an actor. He's really, really good.
Mm.
So it's going to be interesting to see how that looks for Marvel in the next couple of years. I think X-Men 97 has shown great characters, writing well in terms of the storylines and integrating those storylines where we actually care about them.
Yeah.
It's proven for success.
What do you think happened with the writer?
Bo DeMeo.
They're being very vague about it. Like I think
he's spoken about it, you know?
Nah, he can't. He said that he's under like thing that he can't. He said that it was like think creative differences, but he was. If you watch it, he almost says like, "Yo, man, bro, I can't really say it."
Maybe I read it wrong, but I think one of the things that he said again, might be wrong. That with the current X-Men series, obviously X-Men's always been stories about not X-Men. Yeah, X-Men's always been stories about people that are cast in the outskirts of society.
Mm.
And his issue was that so many, like the black characters in this particular season barely had any time as much as usual. And I think that was his biggest complaint.
Interesting.
I'm pretty sure he's come out and spoken about it.
Nah, it was the thing about like how like they done it. And then they said that, he got fired in the press run. It was after it was done and everything. And it was during the press run.
Yeah, yeah.
He got fired. And then they asked him recently, are you in season two? And he was like, well, I already wrote.
Yeah, already wrote it.
Of like season two.
But the post-production being done by somebody else.
Everything's being done by somebody else. I have no input now.
They've got a tough task of living up to the first season just based upon the huge success of it, right?
Well, he's the fun creator, right? Well, he's one of the creators, right?
Yeah. And he did a really good job, man. Like, it's a really, really good series. You finished it now? No, you haven't.
No, yeah.
What are you up to? Be honest.
5.
Not bad.
See, have you finished 5? Or you...
Nah.
Oh!
5 is a good one.
Oh!
Today. Sorry, man. I was in heartbreak mode, man. I was watching films that made me happy.
Okay.
You know.
Go for it.
Nah, I can't. Heartbreak anniversary.
Post credit scene podcast. It's a long episode today, actually. When I think about it, gonna have some editing to do. Good luck, kids. We are the post credit scene podcast. As we said,
Jesus.
A 14 HQ original. We potted today, dog. We've probably got clips for like a good couple of fucking weeks, man.
Do you know what I mean?
Post credit scene podcast of 14 HQ original, lovers of film and TV. We'll be back probably next week to maybe give a quick deep dive into The Bear, House of the Dragon, and The Boys Season 4. And then we're going to go on a bit of a break. Some people got holidays and stuff. Horses are always busy anyway, you know.
To be fair, the pod's probably not going to go.
We got bits for days.
We got the episodes.
Yeah.
We've got episodes for days.
We've got
some bits, fam. So yeah, technically, yeah. We're on a break, but you guys will get good content.
But because we're back next week, we're sort of making up for the facts we're on break. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Lovers of film and TV, drop us a comment on all socials. We are on TikTok, we are on Instagram, we're on YouTube, TikTok and IG mainly as things stand. So get on the follows, get on the content, subscribe. We would like to think we're your best content creators for film and TV.
Hell yeah.
So yeah. For NHK Original, you know the vibes. Boom. Deserve.
Hi, I'm Donald Glover, and you are watching or listening to the Post Credit Scene.